Live from Burbank, California, where we have the pride to hang ourselves at home, not in jail. It's the Mark Maron Show. And now, he can't be left alone with his thoughts. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Good evening, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, pain sponges and need machines. How are you? How was the big weekend? I actually sound worse today than I did on Friday, but I feel better today than I did on Friday. That's how that goes, Jim. It was a rough weekend with the sickness, but this is what I have now. I'm just a big bag of phlegm, and I don't know how the hell long that's
going
to last.
You go on stage at all this weekend?
You just asked me that so you, to fuel your resentment and envy at your lack of a stand-up career, or are you just curious?
No, because I want to revel in the way that you sacrifice your body for the good of the public.
I didn't go anywhere this weekend. I literally stayed in bed most of the weekend or on the couch and just watched television and caught up on work for the show. Got a lot of interesting guests this week that wrote a lot of big books. Spent a lot of the weekend reading parts of the big books so I can be up on what the guests have to say about things. That's how a lot of the weekend was spent. A lot of the weekend was spent reading the newspaper. I don't know about you, but if I'm straddled with the Sunday Times, that's a day. I don't know who the hell these people are who can just read the paper in an hour, but it takes me about 5 hours to get through the bulk of the paper. And then if I'm reading the New York Times Sunday edition on top of that, then it takes me even more time.
The personals alone.
Yeah, I miss those.
Take up a whole day.
My wife's into the real estate thing. That becomes the hobby of those after a certain age, is to see how much the neighborhood is worth and whether we're going to move into the house.
Because you're tired of your starter house.
I am so not tired of it. We're building a fence. We're building a fence along the side to make it more private.
Metaphorical or real fence?
Well, I'm always building fences metaphorically, Jim. I'm building one right now around my heart against you. You evil man.
You know I always get through.
Huh?
You know I always get through.
You know, it's generally not hard to get through my fence. Yeah, but if it's done with a certain amount of finesse, then usually I'll just feel a little hurt. But if it's done abruptly, then there's yelling. And if it's done in a way I can't understand it, then I don't want to be around.
Speaking of yelling, how's that rage control going?
Thank you very much for asking. I'll be honest with you, it's been going very well. And I'll tell you, since I've been sick, Jim, no coffee, just tea, because I want to aggravate myself. So this has been the longest time I've been off coffee in a long time, okay? 3 days, no coffee. Went through the headache already, leveled up. I have to tell you, though I have a propensity to rage, I don't think the coffee helps anything. So, that has helped. But Mr. Against Coffee, you want me to tell you who's on the show? Let me tell you. Gene Pompa. Do you know Gene Pompa?
I've seen him many times. We had a gig a long time ago.
Hey, Little Bear.
Recorded a TV show.
Hey, Little Bear. I can't wait to see Gene Pompa. Makes me laugh. Always has. I hope he's funny on the show. I've never had him in a social situation. I've seen him do stand-up. I've hung out with him. But I've never seen him do radio or heard him do radio. So this will be exciting for everyone. Also, Hart Perry, the producer of the new co-venture by VH1 and Bravo, The Drug Years, a four-hour documentary about the history of modern drug use in this country. This show seems to be doing a lot about drugs lately, but that's okay. It's an important part of our culture. I watched 3 hours of it the other day, and it's very good, very good. He's the producer. We'll talk to him. Towards the end of the show, we are going to talk to Lawrence Bender, who is a producer of An Inconvenient Truth. He's also the producer of all of Tarantino's movies, Pulp Fiction, Kill Bill. He did Good Will Hunting. This guy is a big Hollywood producer, and this is a project that obviously is near to his heart, so we'll talk to him about An Inconvenient Truth and how he got involved with that. Daryl Hannah is going to be with us in a moment, perhaps talking to us from a tree in South Central L.A., and I mean that in a good way. She's calling about the South Central Farm, which is a 14-acre urban farm that was given to the community of South Central after the 1992 riots, and it has been sold by the city to a developer who wants to sell it to build a warehouse or sell it back to the community for an insane profit. And she's there with a lot of other people doing a major sit-in, camp-in protest. Apparently Willie Nelson stopped by yesterday. She's going to be on the phone in just a few minutes. And then at some point, we're going to talk to Army Lieutenant Ronnie Randolph, who is now teaching one of those ethics courses that many of these soldiers at the American military is being forced to take in light of Haditha, the Haditha massacre. I do want to go over some stuff. Did you find anything? You know what? I don't want to talk about movies. Did you find anything exciting in the news, Jim, that jumped out at you? There's a couple things I got, if you want me to share them with you.
Sure, go ahead first.
Jason Leopold, who bailed on us for reasons that are unclear and also has lost the faith of a lot of readers. He writes primarily for Truth Out about the ever-pending Rove indictment, has posted something today at Truth Out saying that there is a sealed versus sealed indictment that came out of Patrick Fitzgerald's the federal prosecutor's office, sealed versus sealed, which means it's not sealed once, it's sealed twice, so no one can know what the hell case it's from. It could be from the Abramoff case, it could be from any of the cases going on that are under federal investigation, it could be from the Plame case, and it's double sealed, so we don't know who it's in relation to, but there are indictments. It seems like Jason Leopold is figuring out a way to let himself off the hook. Perhaps there is a sealed versus sealed indictment, but we should just stop talking about the Rove indictment, because I don't know what I don't know what it means or whether it's going to happen or what. But Leopold thinks he's off the hook. Personally, with my show, he's not off the hook because he bailed on us. Three inmates at Guantanamo killed themselves, committed suicide. The Bush administration is trying to make it seem as though it was some sort of protest, some sort of martyrdom. It couldn't just be the fact that they are being held without charge indefinitely in a prison with no hope of ever getting a case heard or ever getting out, that, and they've been humiliated and tortured, that they couldn't have just decided, why don't we just do this? Now, obviously, these are not good guys. But obviously, this does indicate that Guantanamo is still operating at a level of that transcends Geneva Conventions in terms of what's appropriate. And these guys should at least be allowed to engage in some part of the legal system. Again, not sympathetic necessarily to who these guys are. The guys who killed themselves are very likely, from proof, to be terrorist operatives. But still, the question of what the hell is going on at Gitmo remains.
But until charges are actually filed against them, then how do we know who the hell they were in reality? For real. I mean, we don't know. I mean, they can say anything they want about these people because they didn't file any charges against them, right?
Well, I don't think that the...
Out of 460 inmates there, only 10.
But they're not operating in any sort of real legal frame. They're just holding these guys prisoner.
Yeah.
That there's the only way that they could say that they have, that they are guilty of something is by actions that they claim that they have taken. Yeah, by whatever they say. And we're going to hopefully get Marjorie Cohn on here on Wednesday. She writes for Truth Out, does a lot of great stuff in terms of legal issues around torture, and also talking about this guy, Aaron Watada, the 27-year-old first Army lieutenant who's not going to go. He's not going to go to Iraq. And some guy who was listening to our show on Friday brought to my attention that there was a British officer, a Special Air Services counterterrorist team member, Ben Griffin. This guy was a high-level Brit guy. He was like the equivalent of, I guess it would be the Delta Force, the British equivalent. And he said when he was supposed to go back to Iraq, he said he wasn't going to go for a number of reasons. One being it was an illegal war, and one saying that he didn't join the British Army to conduct American foreign policy. Now, this guy was such a tremendous asset to the British military and such an impeccable record as a soldier that he was not court-martialed, but he was released from duty with accommodations, accommodations from his commanding officer. That he was said to be a great asset to the military and a very smart and courageous guy, and they let him out without any court martial at all, without any damage to his record. That's really interesting. That's all I got on it. I don't know what the process was about that, but if this guy goes up against the U.S. military, this guy Watada, which I think is something we should really keep an eye on, I think he's profoundly courageous for doing so and makes a legal case for this on how they've broken every convention, every international convention around international law in terms of what this war is. It could be a tremendous symbolic gesture. Anyways, we've got to go. We've got Daryl Hannah on the phone. We will be back with her in a moment. Stay with us.
He eats 15% of his body weight every hour. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
Well, I think I sound a little better on this segment, don't I? I sound a little clearer.
Yeah,
it was because of that cough or something. Man. Hey, folks, you may not know about the South Central Farm. It is the largest urban farm in the country. It was given to the South Central L.A. community after the 1992 riots. It spans about 14 acres and helps about 350 farmers sustain their lives. It is a community-building operation. There are events and markets that revolve around this farm. Not long ago, the land was sold by the city to a developer. The developer wants to bulldoze the farm and put a warehouse on it or something. We're going to talk to actress Daryl Hannah, who has been out there camping out on the farm for a few weeks now. She is on the phone to tell us what's going on down there with the struggle to stop this development. Welcome to the show, Daryl Hannah.
Thank you, Mark.
Now, I heard you were in a tree. Are you in a tree?
I have been in and out of a tree, yes. There's a big old walnut tree here that Julia Butterfly Hill, who saved the Redwood Luna, and John Quigley, who was responsible for saving Old Glory, the oak tree in Santa Clarita, have been put some platforms in, and we use it as a sort of a community watchtower. And so there are a few of us that have been trading time up there, spending time up there.
So it's a watchtower to look for what exactly?
Sort of to watch over the community, watch over the garden, alert everybody if the sheriffs or bulldozers are moving in.
My God.
What we're really trying to do is buy time, raise awareness and buy time so that people get to know that this farm exists and can come down here and show their support for it or make donations to show their support for it or let the political powers that be know that it's important to this city and to this and to the country, in fact.
Absolutely. Know? Now, where is it now? Is it really at that point to where bulldozers, you're standing off with machinery?
Well, I mean, we actually, the physical bulldozers aren't here, but the impending threat of them is still present. And in fact, the sheriffs fly over, maybe a dozen times a day. And last night they were flying over with the big, spotlights and shining them into people's tents and stuff. They got their notice of eviction, I guess, about 3 weeks ago.
The farmers did.
We've been trying to buy time to raise the money, and now the money has basically come through from the Annenberg Foundation and the Trust for Public Land, and they're trying to, negotiate a deal. So we're really, really looking to buy time and get the support of the political powers that be to make this deal happen.
Okay, well, let's back up a little and make sure I understand and that the listeners understand that this farm was given to the community in 1992.
After the uprising and as sort of a peace offering and a place for them to have some green space, and they've turned it into a beautiful farm. And I'm sitting in a cornfield right now where I just I just hosed down to clean up a little bit, but there's like five different kinds of colors of corn in this field: red corn, green corn, yellow corn, white corn. There's organic heirloom fruits and vegetables all over the place, traditional medicinal plants. It's just absolutely an amazing place in the middle of South Central LA. And when you said it feeds 350 farmers, it actually feeds 350 families and also all the people who shop here on the farmers markets on Sundays.
Well, that sounds amazing. I feel bad that I've never been there.
Well, I never knew it existed either until about a month and a half ago, and I think most people in the city aren't aware of it, but now people are really realizing that this absolute gem and model of a sustainable urban agriculture exists in our city, and it's something that really needs to be preserved.
Now, let's talk about this guy, the bad guy in all this, the developer who bought the farm for like $5 million, and now he's turning it around and tripling that in selling it?
Yeah, I mean, we're really trying not to portray anybody in this case as a villain. He had a problematic deal thrown his way. It was actually his property in the 80s and taken from him or bought from him by the city in 1987 for $4.8 million. And the way that they sold it back to him was sort of not really on the up and up. And so he was kind of given a problem. So it's not necessarily, you know, that anybody in this case is sort of the evil doer.
No bad guys.
But on the other hand, we would like to encourage him to be, you know, reasonable and compassionate and understand that this means a lot to this community, because it's not just the food that is so incredible about this farm. It's also serves as a safe haven for kids to play and to, you know, learn from their parents and grandparents about nutrition, about where food comes from.
Yeah.
And to avoid, you know, being, you know, having their other options being to, you know, go into gangs and drugs and things like that.
Sure.
It's really an incredible place.
I got to come down there. I heard that Willie Nelson was hanging out yesterday.
Yeah, Willie Nelson was here yesterday. A bunch of the farmers have a band, and they were playing. So Willie danced with one of the women who's a farmer. A lot of the farmers here are women, actually. And it's just it's an incredibly inspiring, magical place. And, I mean, I'm looking at bananas right in front of me, just drip down off the banana trees, and,
really?
And I can see some papayas growing. It's just amazing.
And Mimi Kennedy's down there. She's been on our show, I believe.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, she was down here the other day. Danny Glover. We've had, you know, lots of people coming in and showing, you know, standing in solidarity with the farmers. And the more the merrier. So I really like to encourage people to come down and show your support for the farmers, and more importantly, you know, call the mayor and tell him that how important it is to you.
All right, and also you can go to the website at
www.southcentralfarmers.org.
Now, yeah. Daryl, if you don't mind, can you entertain my co-host? You drive a biodiesel car, right?
Yeah, an 83 El Camino.
He wants to ask a question.
Yeah, you're obviously a friend of the environment and everything. I'm thinking of buying one of these stripped-down old Mercedes and converting it to a grease car, too. Do you know if you have to have a special permit to pick up old grease from restaurants?
Well, if you there's different things. Biodiesel actually isn't SVO. SVO is what you're talking about, straight mm-hmm. veggie oil. That biodiesel is already thinned to the same viscosity as a diesel fuel with vegetable grain alcohol. So you don't have to make any conversion to run biodiesel in your diesel car.
Okay.
If you want to run SVO, then you have to have a minor conversion. And most fast food restaurants will actually pay you to take the grease away, because they have to pay somebody to remove it.
All right, there you go.
I'm sold.
All right. So, Daryl, thank
you. Listen, I want to tell you guys where the farm is so you can come on down and visit.
Okay.
It's at 4000 Long Beach Avenue, which is right off the 10 at Alameda.
Right on. Thanks a lot, Daryl Hannah.
All right. Thank you guys so much.
You take care.
Bye, Mark.
Bye. We'll be back.
He's rethinking the salad. Mark Maron.
Oh, I haven't exercised in like 3 days because I was sick, and I'm feeling a little balmy now. I can't tell if it's a flu or a cold or what.
It's a flold.
Yeah, I don't know. Let's do these because we didn't get to do them. I don't want you to be caught off guard or uninformed out there today, so here's version one of the Mark Maron Show's Short Order News. Three Middle Eastern prisoners being held without charges at Guantanamo Bay hang themselves, prompting new calls for an immediate shutdown. Investigators said the men hanged themselves by using a string of lies provided by the U.S. military. String of lies. No meta. A main ingredient in beer may help prevent prostate cancer and enlargement, according to a new study. The study also found that the same ingredient to be helpful in preventing things like marriage, careers, and erections. German police have arrested a man on suspicion of murdering a woman with a sausage. The suspect said he is innocent, claiming all he said to the woman was, "Here, honey, try this. It's called chorizo." And that's the Short Order News version one for today. Those are funny jokes. There were some funny jokes there. Hey, you know, folks, we've been covering a lot of cultural history on the show. We had Tim Leary's biographer here last week. We had Bob Weir on the phone a couple of weeks ago. Starting tonight on VH1 and later in the month on the, is it on Sundance later in the month?
Starting on the
16th. On the 16th is a series called The Drug Wars. It is a very thorough 4-hour documentary look at the beginning of modern drug culture to where we are now. The producer of that documentary, Hart Perry, is on the phone with us. Welcome to the show, Hart Perry.
Thanks. I'll tell you.
You know, you've done a lot of documentary work, and I got to say, this one was really good. Because I've read a lot about this stuff. I've seen a lot of documentaries. This was compelling. It was informative. And the archival footage you found was amazing. I watched through, I think, the end of the 60s, the first wave. Now, when you were making the film, what did you learn that you didn't know before? What blew your mind?
What I didn't really realize was the fact that prior to around 65, the middle 60s,
yeah,
very few people were involved with illicit drugs.
Right.
Maybe a couple hundred thousand beatniks and jazz musicians. And then a real sort of cultural revolution happened in our society with youth culture, the counterculture, the generation gap, and the beginning of the cultural wars, which we're still seeing today. And drugs were a part of it.
Well, let's listen to Legs McNeil. Yeah, you had Legs on there, and he said this in the documentary.
I don't think the 60s would have happened. The music, the art, the literature, unless it was for LSD. Everybody took this pill and went on this big trip, and it changed their mind.
So, you know, Legs is great, and you had a lot of great people in this thing, and you know what I loved about it? I don't know where the hell you found some of this stuff, but you had old interviews of cats from the 70s and 80s, like, you know, you had Peter Fonda and Jerry Garcia and Ken Kesey, who, you know, it's so sad because he's dead. Now, did you do those interviews with him, or where'd you find this stuff?
Those were archival interviews, and I really have to give props to my wife and partner, Dana Perry,
uh-huh,
who's I've spent the last, you know, 20 years really, you know, specializing in archival research.
Oh, and she found all that stuff?
She was the leader in unearthing that material.
Oh, man, there was stuff, Tim Leary stuff that I'd never seen before, and the Kesey interviews were just great. And I just found that, you know, in the documentary, you were really able to capture something we've talked about here on the show before, just about the impact of the Vietnam War, the reaction of the kids, the music, the political movements, and then the entire selling out of the 60s. And it just put them into a historical context I hadn't seen before. What's your hope with this documentary, ultimately?
Well, my hope is that, you know, kids will learn something about drugs. So what happened in the 60s, and actually, you know, throughout the war on drugs, and it continues to today, is that there's a lot of misinformation. You know, kids are told that if they smoke pot, it'll lead to, you know, heroin addiction.
And are they
it's a
still
much
told
more,
that?
You know, complex story. And if they try, you know, a drug that seems benign, then they don't believe anything. And then try some drugs which, you know, like methamphetamine and crack and, you know, really highly, you know, dangerous, toxic drugs.
Yeah. So basically your message is that, you know, hey, kids, just try the good drugs.
Well, it's a little more complicated than that. But I think, you know, the kids, you have to just be factual. You know, this is what's happened. You know, you can see for yourself that there were, you know, casualties from the drug experimentation in the 60s. But there was a cultural movement that also occurred.
Well, I think that's important. I really think that, Hart Perry, if I could put my two cents into what I think this documentary shows better than anything I'd ever seen previous, is that this counterculture movement, you know, before it was, you know, before it was appropriated by Madison Avenue and made tangible to the rest of the culture, was a very honest to God threat to the status quo and to capitalist culture. And I never really realized that until I saw some of the footage you had on there of Leary. And specifically, there's one piece of footage of Harry Reasoner, the news anchor, walking through the Haight-Ashbury, and he's saying that this is one of these hippie colonies. And I never heard that language before, and I realized that they were really scared that there was a colonization of a type of lifestyle that they might not be able to control. And I never really, it never was captured as well as I had seen in your documentary before.
Well, that's great. I appreciate it. It was, you know, it was really the beginning of the cultural wars.
Yeah.
Which had a political implication.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, as far as the anti-war movement, this was a new thing, you know, putting flowers in the guns of the MPs at the Pentagon, and it was about peace and love, but it was also about being involved in the issues of the day, and we have similar issues also.
That's
another,
right.
Another war.
That's right. And it also puts everything into context into terms of the first wave of the BNs and the first wave of acid culture, and then the sort of the second wave once it became more mainstream. And also, one thing I find about these documentaries when I see them is that as beautiful as it all seemed and as exciting and countercultural as it all seemed, there's really no way to live like that every day.
Well, it was a utopian vision, you know. And
but you look at it after a certain point, okay, you've danced, you've tripped, you've stayed up for 3 days. What do you do now? But, you know, I mean, do you just keep doing that?
Well, if the 60s were about exploring spiritual values, the 70s was about just getting loaded.
Yeah.
You know, that the war in Vietnam was over. Many of the, you know, changes that had occurred had been resolved, and people just wanted to sort of dance on tombstones, go to the disco.
That go to the disco and, yeah, and just get wasted. I guess that's sort of when I came up. I mean, I don't know how old you are. I'm 42, and by the time I was in starting to do drugs, you know, in high school, it was all long past. I mean, it was the late 70s already.
Well, I was actually the youngest cameraman in the Woodstock movie.
Really?
Yeah, when it started to rain and or people wanted a crowd shot that was like 2 miles away, I would, you know, get those assignments.
Give it to Hart. Where's Hart, man? I'm too high and it's raining.
But that was, you know, a remarkable situation to have, you know, 500,000 people together and, you know, loaded and nothing really bad happening.
Well, you know, it was also interesting to me that you sort of capture in the movie that that was really the end of it. That, you know, that for most practical purposes, when you really see how close everything was together, Altamont, Charles Manson, Martin Luther King's death, Hendrix, Joplin, and Morrison all dying, Robert Kennedy, all this, you know, really just happens in the circle of a couple of years there, that it just put the kibosh on it. And Woodstock was really that was the swan song almost, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was almost an anomaly. It was, you know, it started in San Francisco, really, you know, with Ken Kesey and the acid trips that then became what we know as the contemporary concert experience, you know, light shows, bands, dancing. And from this, you know, small group of people, something, you know, went out into society. And once that happens, things can get complicated. You know, you get a Charlie Manson, the musicians who experimented with drugs, you know, try other drugs, which are, you know, lethal.
Yeah, that stuff you have in there of Hendrix and Martin Torgoff. I guess we have Martin Torgoff talking about the beginning of it, but then you can talk a little bit about him because he's really the voice throughout this thing. This is Martin Torgoff, I think, on the inception or the roots of what became the countercultural movement.
One of the things that Kerouac, Burroughs, and Ginsberg were finding in drugs was something that was completely revolutionary to them. And that was how the experience of certain substances like marijuana and amphetamines could bring you more into the experience of the moment. They were trying to live exactly the way the jazz musicians were blowing.
That was Martin, right?
That was Martin. Martin was the inspiration of this series.
Uh-huh.
His book, Can't Find My Way Home.
Yeah, I have that book. Yeah.
Really what inspired this whole thing. And he was a collaborator, not just an interview subject. He's really, you know, central to the whole, you know, concept of the series.
Yeah. I heard his voice throughout, and I think he was essential in putting it into a historical context. Now, let's talk about where it's going to be on. Now, this is unique because it's going to be on both Bravo or Sundance and VH1.
It starts on VH1
tonight.
This week, tonight, 9 o'clock, and it's going to run all week.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the 16th, it starts on Sundance.
And I'll tell you, to the people who are listening, there is footage on here you've never seen before. And I don't know. From when I was a little kid, I was always enamored with this period of time. And the first 3 hours, which I watched, I couldn't stop watching. And I think it's a great documentary. It's very informative and reasonable.
And that's wonderful.
Yeah. And anything else you want to add on there, Hart, before we take off?
It's my hope that you know, the kids can learn something about drugs and the impact on our culture.
Well, they certainly will. And I imagine a couple of kids are going to be like, I wonder if you can still get that one.
Yeah, like Quaaludes.
Exactly. Take care, Hart.
Okay, thanks.
You bet, man.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So hopefully when we get back, we can get this this Army lieutenant on the phone. All right, yeah, we're gonna try to do that. I don't know where that's gonna go, but we'll give it a try. Army Lieutenant Ronnie Randolph, one of the Army's ethics trainers, in a moment.
He lived his life like a jazz musician blows.
God, I wish I did. I wish I was closer to that. You know what's amazing about Al Zarqawi getting killed?
Is what?
That, well, it just turns out that everything that we always assumed was happening was happening. This guy was building a global network of terrorists, dispatching them from Iraq where he was training them.
More importantly, he was hanging out with scantily clad women.
Was he?
Yes.
Of course. Well, he was a rebel. He's an outlaw. He was a pirate. He was an evil man. I don't think I'm being sympathetic, but I wonder if Glenn Beck would have made the masturbatory sounds he was making at the footage of 500-pound bunker-busting bombs being dropped on this safe house if he had known two kids were being killed there. I wonder if he would have been making the masturbatory sounds that Glenn Beck going, ooh, ah, look at that bomb blow up. But
maybe he's watching Anderson Cooper with his tape loop of that.
Point being, Jim Earl,
yes?
That there was no terrorism in Iraq before the Americans were there, before the invasion. But now there is more substantiated evidence that somebody was building an international network of terrorists from Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which named its predecessor today. I don't know anything about him. Maybe we'll get some more information. It's not even clear who he is exactly. But let's get into some more Army business, because okay, we do have military on the ground there. And as many of you know, after news of the Haditha massacre hit the mass media, the Pentagon was quick to announce that all military personnel would receive hands-on military ethics training courses in hopes of teaching the troops legal, moral, and ethical standards on the battlefield. With us now on the phone is one of the trainers, I guess you could call him, or instructor of one of the military ethics courses, Army Lieutenant Ronnie Randolph. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you for having me on the show, Mr. Marin. I appreciate it.
Well, we're happier here. Look, after Haditha and a few other events, I think it's pretty clear to most people that the troops were not prepared to address ethical concerns, that they were not trained properly. Do you find that to be the case, sir?
I have to disagree with you completely. As Donald Rumsfeld himself says, the troops are sufficiently trained. I mean, that's coming from Donald Rumsfeld. So if he says it, you know it's true. All right.
I don't know about that.
No, it's pretty true. I mean, I trust Donald Rumsfeld. He sent us out to this war to fight for our country, and he wouldn't just do that. Like, it wouldn't be a joke for him to do that. He wouldn't do that just to be silly.
Well, so what are the problems then? I mean, if that's true, and then we have these issues where you got guys killing civilians with a certain amount of malice, whose fault is that?
Again, I think, you know, this ethics training, it's not so much because the soldiers are insufficiently trained. It's more so that the Iraqis never had any ethics training. They didn't have an ethics seminar, so we have to pick up the slack for them.
Wait. So somehow or another, this is the Iraqis' fault?
I don't want to put blame on anybody, but yes.
All right. Well, look. I don't see how that's possible, but let's move on. So the training that the troops are getting, how does the training work?
Basically, we put the soldiers through about five or so different scenarios.
Uh-huh.
And what I do is I put them through the scenarios, and there's a proper way, the ethical answer on how to get out of the situation, and so we just kind of put them through these situations and see how they respond.
All right, let me give it a shot. Can you just tell me what they are, and I can answer, and you can tell me if I'm right or wrong?
Sure, yeah. I can put you through a test. I can put you through an ethics test right now.
Okay.
All right, so here's scenario number one.
Right.
Let's say you enter the house of an Iraqi man, and you find a rocket-propelled grenade. Now, the man asks not to be cuffed with his family watching.
Yeah.
What do you do?
He's got a rocket-propelled grenade?
He's got a rocket-propelled grenade.
Well,
I think... You're going to arrest him.
You arrest him.
Right, but he doesn't want to be handcuffed in front of his family.
Well, so what? Maybe you walk him outside. You walk him outside. And you handcuff him.
No, you handcuff his whole family.
Oh.
Because you don't know that's not his kid's rocket-propelled grenade.
Right.
Kids have war toys. You don't know that that's not maybe the wife. Maybe that's her rocket-propelled grenade.
Right.
It's a good message that you need to send to those children not to have a rocket-propelled grenade.
Okay, all right. So what's the next one?
All right, question number two. You enter a house with only women and children present and find explosives. The female head of the household is involved with explosives. What do you do?
I arrest all of them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You are very ethical, Mark Maron.
All right.
Incredibly ethical. You arrest all of them. If they're cute, you still arrest them.
Wait, what the hell does that have to do with anything?
Just because there are some situations where maybe you might think, oh, well, the cute one's not involved.
All right. I understand. That makes sense.
Yeah, in most situations, you usually think it's the ugly lady that's trying to mess stuff up. And the cute one's just there because, you know, her ugly friends say, come hang out. There'll be, you know, food and a good time, drinks.
Right. Okay. So why don't we move on to the next one?
Next question.
All right.
Okay. You're entering a house where a known threat is living.
Yeah.
But when you get there, the family is praying. Mm. How do you proceed?
You say, hey, what's going on? Let's do this.
I'm going to stop you.
What?
What you do is first you need to find out who they're praying to. If they're praying to God,
yeah.
To our God, Jesus,
right?
Then you let them pray. Mm. They're probably not as much of a threat.
All right. Well, fine. What's the next one?
You see a baby and smile at it,
yeah.
But the baby cries at you. How do you proceed?
You go, oh, and you keep moving.
You arrest the baby. That baby might be a terrorist.
Oh, yeah.
That baby obviously has malicious thoughts towards you that it started to cry. It has malicious thoughts towards America and to our Marines. Mm. So you arrest that baby.
All right. I kind of blew that one. All right. What's the next one?
You get sick in your stomach, like maybe a stomach virus, after eating at a local restaurant. How do you respond?
You don't eat there anymore, and you wait till it passes.
No, you destroy the restaurant. You can't make that same mistake twice.
Right.
So you destroy the restaurant because that's clearly they were trying to take you out of commission with a little stomach virus with you know some bad chicken.
Maybe you couldn't just be that our standards are different.
I don't think our standards. Yes, ethically our standards are different, and that's the type of game we're playing out there in Iraq. We're playing with a full deck of cards, and they're playing with like a basketball. And you can't play cards and basketball at the same time.
I understand. I think Army Lieutenant Ronnie Randolph. It was a pleasure. We'll have to continue this conversation another time.
Thank you for having me, Mr. Maron. You're incredibly ethical.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time.
We'd love to have you in the Army anytime.
All right. Take care. We'll be back with Gene Pompa.
And now I got to update my website. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Very excited. In a few minutes, my friend Gene Pompa is going to be here, who I've tried to get on the show for like weeks now, but it's hard to get hold of because there's several different websites and you get emails back from people that don't talk like they know him. I swear to God, I sent emails trying to get you on the show and someone write back. It's like, Gene's not in right now. I'm like, who the hell is this?
It's a weird bogus website I have with latinostandup.com.
Oh, hold that thought because that sounds exciting. We're going to do this bit first. This is, we just got a dispatch. Zarqawi died, so of course, Al-Qaeda News had to be on it, so we were able to pick this up off the web. This is the Al-Qaeda News.
From across the nation, around the world, and under a burqa, this is Al-Qaeda News with hosts Muhammad and Mahmoud.
I am Muhammad. I am Mahmoud. And we will destroy you! Today we have some very good news.
Oh, good. I like good news.
Our leader in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, has been killed.
But that's good news?
Yes, the sated Zarqawi has been martyred and has gone to paradise. He is to be congratulated.
I just don't see how that's good news for us.
Look, we're supposed to spin every story so they're all good news. Why can't you get with the program, idiot?
Yeah, I'm not the idiot. You're the idiot.
No, you are.
Look, I have some actual good news. You want to hear it or not?
Donkey ass!
Okay. Anti-terrorist funding to New York City has been cut by 40%.
My news is still better.
Your news isn't even good! Anyway, the funding got cut because Michael Chertoff, the head of Homeland Security, since the city doesn't have any national monuments or icons.
Oh, boy, you're kidding me.
I don't kid. Jokes are not mentioned by the prophet.
What about the Rockettes? I love the Rockettes.
Again with the Rockettes. You saw one Christmas show at Radio City Music Hall, and you never shut up about it.
Don't insult the Rockettes in the city of radios. Take this.
Oh, yeah? Here, have some pepper.
Try some of that, too.
Oh, yeah.
Take that back
now
and replace it with this.
I blow you up now.
Oh, take this and that.
I blow you up again.
Take that, too, and I'll blow you up.
Okay, about then I'm firing you.
Then I'm firing you and then blowing you up.
You can't fire me.
No, I can fire you.
Hi, this is Tina, the weather girl at Al-Qaeda News. For his work with Al-Qaeda and his generous assistance in making New York City an easier and most desirable target for another attack, Al-Qaeda News presents Michael Chertoff with its Imperialist Swine of the Year Award. May you be met in paradise by 40 virgins of your own choosing.
I think I got you a little bit more.
Okay, I'm tired.
How do we keep missing?
Anyway, thank you, Tina. That's all for this week. I am Muhammad.
I am Mahmoud.
And remember, our news is bad news.
For you!
Oh, yeah? Well, take
that. No, take that.
No, you take that.
Take that, return this, and then replace it with that.
No, take that.
Oh, you should take some of this.
Blow you up twice.
I have something right now. I'll blow you up.
No, I blow you up three times.
Oh, you're fired. Get out. No, I'm trying to get fired. No, I need a fuck.
No,
you are dead and fired.
Oh, how funny is terrorism?
Man, those guys
are hilarious.
They're incompetent.
I didn't know they were Mexican.
Yeah, everyone's Mexican, Gene.
I didn't know. I didn't know there were a bunch of Chicanos over there. I was there.
Gene Pompa has been on Conan O'Brien like 8 times. He's been on all the, what do you call them, the Latino shows?
CTV, whatever.
Uh-huh, he's written for shows. He's a funny guy. I think I met you like, that's been like 15 years, right?
Yep.
Man, remember when we were young and you had hair and stuff?
Oh, my God.
Wow, that was some
time.
I had
a washboard stomach.
Washboard stomach. You used to have the shark skin suit and be all cool.
Yep. You could give a Hummer like it was nobody's
business. Hey, wait a minute. You must be talking about some girl that looks like me.
I remember that, yeah.
Oh, wait a second. That wasn't me. You guys are freaking me out.
Well, that was the young Mark Maron, the party animal.
Oh, maybe it was a party. I didn't remember.
Winnie and Gus.
That's all right, buddy. Yeah, I know. All right, so thanks for doing that. That's great.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, sure, man. So what are you, a Mexican or a Chicano or Latin American or Mexican American?
Gene Pompa is a Mexican American.
Yeah.
All four of my grandparents are from Mexico.
Is that true?
Yeah. Chicano means basically an American born Mexican.
Okay, so yeah. Because when I was growing up in New Mexico, the Chicanos had, there was a different thing going on. There was Chicanos, and then there's Latinos, but Latinos pretty new, right?
Latinos came out probably in the 80s because of the influx from Central America with all the political unrest. We started getting a lot of El Salvadorans and Hondurans and Nicaraguans.
So everyone became Latino?
Yeah, to sort of encompass everyone that was sort of from a Spanish-speaking country. That's sort of how they did it. And there was a backlash against the term Hispanic because a bunch of self-appointed Latino leaders decided that our government got together in a room and had this conspiracy to call us Hispanics to somehow, I don't know, dilute our political power or whatever.
It made no sense?
It doesn't make any sense. And, you know, if our government's not capable of seeing two airliners go into a big old hunkin' building, I really don't think they got the time to get into a room to have that kind of an agenda.
Oh, boy.
You know, little Annette.
These guys seem very, very diligent in little agendas, but I don't know. That one seems a little questionable.
Well, that one,
when you were growing up, though, what'd your family call themselves?
Mexican-Americans.
Okay.
Always. Right. We never call ourselves Chicanos, not till we got a little older.
Yeah.
We didn't like it. It was bad. It was kind of bad at first. It was.
What, Chicano was bad?
It was derogatory. It was like being called colored, you know. It took on that kind of a connotation.
What kind of, when you were in school, were you like, did you go with other Mexican Americans or what?
Yeah. I was born in East LA, but I grew up in Pico Rivera and La Mirada. Uh-huh. And Pico Rivera, working class suburb of East LA, was predominantly Mexican American.
Yeah.
But everyone spoke English.
Right, right.
You know, when we were kids, our parents didn't really encourage us to keep our Spanish or to develop our Spanish-speaking skills because the Mexican-American that owned the corner grocery store spoke English. So
Right.
You know, the rule of thumb was like, well, who are going to speak Spanish to? Everyone speaks English, even the Mexican-Americans.
So it was like sort of like the pressure to pass.
It wasn't a pressure to pass. It was just sort of an organic, you know, thing. It wasn't really necessary or prudent to learn Spanish.
Right.
You know, it really kind of didn't work that way.
Did you have relatives that were more, like, aggressive than others or?
Oh, yeah, man. Oh, hell yeah. I had this uncle from East L.A. And before I started school, he wanted to indoctrinate me with all his political ideals, right?
Yeah.
He's this Korean War veteran.
Yeah.
So he tells me, mijo, what are you going to say the first day of school when the teacher asks you to stand up and introduce who you are? And I said, I'm going to say, hey, everybody, my name is Gene. Everybody, like that. Niño. And he goes, no, you got to say my name is Gene Pompa. I'm Mexican-American, but I am Chicano to the bone. I said, all right, you know, I'll try to remember that. So first day of school, teacher calls on me. I said, yeah, my name is Gene Pompa. I'm Mexican-American. I'm a Chicano, give you the bone. Yeah, they gave me 2 weeks off. They were really nice over there at the university.
Oh, man.
No, I'll tell you, I was in the, you know what? I love the irony and the hypocrisy sometimes from fellow Americans. Like,
yeah.
I was in this Mexican restaurant. This guy next to me starts bitching at the waiter. He goes, I'm sorry. I don't talk Mexican. I said, you mean speak Spanish? He goes, well, I don't talk Spanish. I said, yeah, well, you also don't speak English. You should make an effort to educate yourself so you can learn yourself to talk gooder. He's all talk gooder. Oh. It's speak weller. Like this.
Man.
That, see, but it's always bizarre when people say that. And he didn't speak no English. Yeah, well, neither do you.
I tell you, I wish I could speak Spanish. I tried. I can't speak anything. My brother speaks a little Spanish because he lived in South America for a while. But I feel bad. I'm ashamed that I don't know more than one. Do you speak Spanish pretty well?
No, I'm ashamed also now. You know, I didn't know that it was going to be this big.
Yeah.
You know? It's like MySpace and computers. I never thought it'd really take off, you know?
You should have kept up, huh?
Yeah, I'm telling you, it took a life of its own. You know, so it's funny. Like, I'll catch myself in situations with other Latinos, and they'll say stuff like, oh, that's horrible. Your Spanish is terrible, whatever they say, right?
Yeah.
I'm like, well, your English sucks. You don't hear me criticizing you. Lighten up, you know?
Well, we talked about, who were we talking to? Madrigal was in here, you know, Al.
Uh-huh.
And, he's got people coming up to him pronouncing his name with the Spanish pronunciation, and he doesn't pronounce it like that.
Oh, it happens all the time. Like, you go to the DMV, and if there's a Hispanic or a Latina behind the counter, you go, hi, Gene Papa here. Gene Bumpa? He's like, yeah, I know how to say my name. You know, I know how to pronounce my name. All right? Just go with the flow. What do you
we were talking about that how the Mexicans pushed the Jews out of your neighborhood. Is that what you're telling me?
They had to. The Jewish gangs at the time were extraordinarily violent, and so they had to get them out of there. Because the Mexicans are a nonviolent group of gangs.
But what was the history of LA?
Gangs of peace.
Jim was asking, what neighborhood were we just talking about?
You said, well, Echo Park. I live in Echo Park. That was a big Cuban neighborhood, wasn't it?
I'm not sure, because when that neighborhood sort of evolved, we weren't really part of the equation. We went from East L.A. kind of east.
Yeah.
Pico Rivera.
Highland Park is full of your people.
Yeah, Highland Park's a little gnarly now.
I live there.
Yeah,
I'm happy to live there. Do you like it? Sure.
Well,
I grew up with your people.
It's kind of a hipster hangout, though, also, isn't it?
I don't know. I don't see
Come
many.
Come on, you pretentious son of a bitch. No, it's a hipster hangout, isn't
it? That's Eagle Rock.
Oh, that's right, Eagle
Rock. I'm not seeing. I think the hipsters are still a little afraid of the flats in Highland Park. So you want to hang out for a minute, and then we're going to come back and do a thing with, I think Sammy the Stem Cell is going to be here, and then you can hang out for that, because it's funny, and you're here. And
Is he Chicano?
Well, he can be. Where do you live?
I live near Seal Beach.
I don't know where the hell that is. All right, we're with Gene Pompa. We'll be back in a second.
Depressed because you haven't heard anything funny yet? Well, me too. Well, all that's about to change, maybe, because Mark Maron's Short Order News is coming up next.
He's deficient in vitamin D, Mark Maron.
I'm so full of vitamins right now from being sick, man, eating all that orange juice. Gene Pompa's still in the house. How are you, buddy?
Good.
You're going to hang out. We're going to do a bit.
All right. Beautiful.
All right. Now to help us sort out some of the latest developments and issues surrounding stem cell research, we have a very controversial guest, Sammy the Stem Cell. Welcome, Sammy.
Hi. I'm Sammy the Stem Cell. I'm Sammy the Stem Cell. Dee doo dee dum dee doo. I'm Sammy the Stem Cell. Hey, Mark.
What?
F*** you. I'm Sacred Life. I did your wife. I'm Sammy the Stem Cell, dee doodly dum dee doo.
God, I hate that song.
Me too.
Then why do you sing it?
Well, Mark, because, you know, I've come on your show so many times now, and each time I seem to cause you pain.
Mm.
I wanted to show you there's more to me than just being mean-spirited and bitter.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I sang it because I thought you'd like it. I guess I sang it because I think of you as, well, my friend.
Well, gosh, Sammy, I'm kind of touched by that. Thank you. Now I suppose you're going to disarm this tender moment by saying something horribly inappropriate.
No chance there, Christ Killer. Can we move on now?
Okay. Well, what's your reaction? Hey! You just call me Christ Killer.
No, Phyllis Diller. Phyllis Diller, that's what I said. I love Phyllis Diller.
Oh.
You puling butt weasel. Come on, bring it on.
Okay. What's your reaction to Harvard University starting its own program to clone human embryos and extract stem cells?
Well, seeing as how I'm sacred life, I think that's all crap. Crap. Just what we need, more Harvard interns for Al Franken.
Why can't you ever see the bigger picture here, Sammy? Don't you care that cloning human embryos can help humanity focus on curing specific diseases?
Yeah, exactly the kind of bung sludge I'd expect from a tedious bluster monkey like yourself. Evidently, this country is required to marinate in your exquisite personal agony. Look at you, reveling in your status as a celebrity and stalked by grief paparazzis. I never have never seen someone enjoying their husband's death so much.
What the hell are you talking about? I don't even have a husband, Sammy. What the hell is this? You're just repeating word for word what that bitch Ann Coulter said.
That's right. I don't want to grow up to be Hitler anymore. I want to be Ann Coulter. She can say anything she wants and get paid for it. Look at you. You said much worse than her and even put out a book. Now you're using unsold copies to pave your driveway. And why? Because nobody cares what a lunatic says when they're a balding Jew with chin implants.
What?
Yeah. Let a skinny blonde chick do it, and she's on the friggin' bestseller list. It's sexist, I tell you.
Look, this is the lowest level you've ever sunk to.
Come on, Mark. You do her if you have the chance.
I love my wife.
That makes two of us, if you know what I mean.
You're disgusting.
And you're welcome.
You're not sacred life. You're just a hideous reminder of the brutality of nature.
Whatever gets you off, Shylock. By the way, here's your vibrator back.
That's not my vibrator. Hey, ow!
It is now.
Hey, get out of here. You make me sick.
Yeah. Oh, blow it out your ass, you punchy rage monkey. Ann Coulter says I'm sacred life.
Yeah, well, you.
You love me!
I hate you! Leave!
You! Fool! I'm your future!
Off!
Sour-faced goose butt!
Yeah, you stink. Get out of here.
No, I'm gonna get out of here when I choose to get out
of
here.
I'm tired of you.
Get your hand off me!
Okay, you get out of here. I'm gonna throw you out.
Well, who's your manager? Who's booking that place?
You send Jim back in here after you get my footprint off your dumb, slimy butt. That's excellent, man. Excellent. Did you like that, Gene?
Yeah.
That's a little bit of theater we do here on the show.
But is it stem cell or sem cell?
It's stem cell.
Oh, okay.
Did I say stem cell? Did
no,
you say
I said it. I have a hard time saying it. Stem cell.
Yeah, no wonder.
Can I say it every time? No wonder the bit doesn't work? Yeah, don't blame it on me.
No, I'm saying no wonder Lori David doesn't want to talk to you. You can't even say your lines right.
My friend, it's not a matter of whether she wants to talk to us or not. It's a matter of whether or not she can be a friend of the show. This is
what does this
home.
Got to do with Gene Pompa?
One of the greatest comedians ever in the 818.
Gene Pompa?
714 area.
So what the hell happened, man? Do you still got that girlfriend or what?
Yeah, I married her finally. You know, I decided to step it up.
Yeah?
We have a mortgage. We have a dog. You have a kid.
Yeah.
I was like, man, I kept thinking I was going to leave in 2 weeks. Oh, for sure, I'm leaving in 2 weeks. I'm just going to bail.
That's good.
And then it didn't work out. 10 years slipped by before I knew it.
10 years slipped by, and you
yeah.
looking at your kid and your dog and your girlfriend saying, I'm out of here. you're really making a case for yourself being a good guy.
And the other, and the truth is, you know, she's she knows format with scripts.
Yeah.
And she makes more money than me.
Yeah, and apparently she also answers your emails.
She takes care of everything. She booked my half hour on Comedy Central.
When are you doing that?
I already did it. But
how'd
she booked
it?
It went great.
Yeah?
Yeah, it was cool.
Would you stretch out some of those jokes?
You know I'm a riffer. I just riffed it. I riffed the whole 30, baby.
Did you?
I don't need script, man. Really? I don't need structure.
Did you wear the hat?
No.
No hat?
No, but I rode a skateboard.
Oh, all right.
I came out of the board and I did a couple 360s for
No, you did not.
I kid you not.
Come on.
I don't know why. I always wanted to be on TV on my skateboard when I was a kid.
You were a skateboard kid?
Yeah.
Did you do pulls and stuff?
Yeah, I did pulls, yeah.
You did?
This was back in the late 70s in Southern California.
When it was happening?
Yeah, when it was, you know, when Dogtown guys were doing their thing.
Yeah, you were one of them?
I wasn't one of them. We were, you know, in the suburbs. We were doing it there. Everyone was doing pool rides.
I never did no pool rides.
Really? It was. You know what was interesting? It wasn't like it is now. You would be lucky to hit the light or hit the tile.
Yeah.
Or come up on the lip.
Right.
Nobody was getting air or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that was that one guy.
Yeah, that was like really astounding. And now everybody does that.
Yeah, I know. Do you do that now?
No, I can barely ride a board. Dude, I was practicing in New York for the special. I thought I was going to kill myself. I'm like,
but you surf. You surf out there.
I surf every so often.
Do you, so what's going on? You got a gig coming up? We got to go.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Good for you. Is there Carson Daly coming? That's about it.
Oh man, that show.
I haven't booked it.
Oh, how? Why is that guy on television? I shouldn't say it.
He's funny.
Wow. And you're gonna say anything to me about kissing up to Laurie David? Did you just hear that?
Man, why didn't you kiss up to Carson Daly? He's more powerful than she is.
No, I don't know. He seems like a nice guy. Hey, we'll see you later. You got a website or anything?
Yeah, GenePompaComedy.com, and you can look for my CD, Chicano to the Bone.
All right, see you later, Gene.
He's dressed by the Olsen twins, Mark Maron.
Hey, come on now. Thank you, Jim. We're back here. It's very exciting that we are about to talk to a big Hollywood producer who I've talked to before on my old show. This guy produces all of Tarantino's films. He produced Pulp Fiction, Kill Bill, Reservoir Dogs. He's also produced The Mexican. He produced that. He's huge. I can't even believe how many movies this guy's produced. And he doesn't look much older than me, which just goes to show you that I have done nothing with my life. But Lawrence Bender also produced An Inconvenient Truth with a group of other producers. He's on the phone to talk to us about that right now. Welcome to the show, Lawrence Bender.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice to be here.
It's nice to talk to you again. Now, I don't want to be rude, but how old are you? Seriously.
I'm 48.
Oh, okay. So I'm 42, so I could still probably produce 20 movies in the next 6 years.
Exactly. I drink a lot of milk.
Yeah, okay. All right. Yeah. Well, yeah.
I have my hair.
All right. Well, how about the Mark Maron film? Is it weird for me to pitch that right now?
Right. If your listeners want to hear you pitch that, go right ahead.
It's a hilarious movie about a guy who had a lot of big hopes and dreams and really believes that he's an inspired, brilliant guy, but the world just doesn't understand him, and he lives in the garage of his brother's house.
God, it sounds kind of sad. I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, man.
Can you do it?
Well, he gets married at the end, and everything turns out well, and he's a movie producer.
Well, now there's a Hollywood ending.
Oh, thank God we pulled it around. All right, let's not talk about that movie. Let's talk about The Inconvenient Truth and your involvement in that. Now, I remember talking to you about this. I believe we were talking about this on my old morning show. But it's come to pass, and it's very popular. What brought you to the film initially? Have you always been an activist kind of guy?
Well, boy, I've been an activist quite a while. Interestingly enough, I made a movie called Good Will Hunting.
Yeah,
you've probably heard about. And we screened that movie in Camp David in 1998. And I tell you, I'd never met a politician before. And spending an entire day with our Good Will Hunting gang, and then along with the President of the United States and Hillary and Madeleine Albright and Sandy Berger and Tom Daschle and all these extraordinary people, it made me realize that, you know, these guys really make a difference in the way we all live, and I felt like that's the part of my life that was missing, and I needed to sort of get involved, and that kind of sent me off in a really, that was one of those moments, you know.
Sure,
and,
sure.
So I've been very active ever since then, and so on this movie, what happened was Laurie David had put together a presentation, a group of people were out to give a presentation to in L.A., in Hollywood, and myself and one of the other producers, Scott Burns, was there. And I saw it, and I just felt like, you know, I thought I knew a lot about global warming. I read the paper, of course, I listen to the news. But not until I saw this presentation did I understand how much I didn't know and what a crisis this is and what could I do about it. And knowing the power we have of media, that would be the way to get the word out to millions.
So you saw a presentation, maybe a tape of Al Gore's show, basically.
No, I actually saw Al Gore give his presentation.
Oh, so you went and saw the presentation.
I saw him give his presentation live, yeah.
Was it a private event?
Yeah, it was an event for a few hundred people in Hollywood, and a bunch of people came.
Wow. And, who else was there?
Who else? Oh, God. I don't know. A lot of people.
I just find it impressive that, like, you're a guy that's produced all these great movies and been around all these great stars, and still politicians struck you as being impressive and doing something good in the world.
Well, you know, I mean, I feel like a lot of people I know, we spend a lot of time with our day job, which is making movies, but also a big part of our life is dedicated to trying to make a difference. And so, yeah, I mean, it's...
Yeah. So now let me ask you this. If now in terms of picking the director and in terms of the people that were involved, and by the way, please say hi to Lori David for us, because I think she's mad at us. And I'd love it if you, Lawrence Bender, were to say, hey, Mark Maron says hi.
I'll see if I can broker a peace treaty between
them. That would be so good, because we didn't mean to upset her. We just, but in the film... In terms of the presentation that you saw, is that basically the same show that he takes on the road when he presents it, or were there things done differently under the direction of Davis Guggenheim?
Well, first of all, his presentation is so inspiring. It's so motivating, and it's so incredible.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, he was the pure inspiration. Al Gore was the pure inspiration, and I knew it needed to be made into a movie. I didn't have any idea how, really. I mean, I thought it could be done, but... The guy who really made it happen is our director, Davis Guggenheim.
Yeah.
He is the, besides Al Gore, the real star of this movie, because he took what really already was an extraordinary thing or a presentation, but found a way to visualize it and make it into a cinematic piece, which people like Roger Ebert are saying, you know, two thumbs up and a masterpiece. And we've had so many great reviews from people from Fox to Seattle News to all across the board. Conservative and liberal reviewers alike, our director, Dave Guggenheim, really had this vision. And the two things he brought to it were, one, how to just make what is a presentation visual and fun and entertaining to watch.
How much of that wasn't part? You mean you're telling me that a lot of that was not part of his regular presentation?
No. There's the presentation itself was very strong as it was, but the director came up with a whole way to shoot it that really got you engaged. The second thing he did was figured a way in, because, you know, you might imagine that something like that could be not engaging. But he, Davis, found a way to really make it personal. And forgetting about the science and the educational aspect, it works as an piece of entertainment. And that's purely, really, as a director, I just so fell in love with Davis. I've known him forever, but working with him was just such a wonderful experience.
Yeah, no, I think he did a great job. And just to personalize the interview a little bit, I sat next to Davis at a wedding many years ago that he wouldn't remember. I just thought I'd bring that up because I want to make sure we're all, you know, just because I'm on a little radio show doesn't mean I'm not part of the big business, right?
What makes you biased?
Yeah. Well. Look. Let's,
not fair and balanced.
That's, of course, I'm biased, and that's the other question I want to ask you. Yeah. Is that show business? You know, has been characteristically aligned with progressive politics, mm-hmm. and I believe there are many reasons for that, because so much of what we do in terms of expression and freedom of thought, and so much of about what the business is really built on, is really about freedom of expression and progressive ideas. Don't you think?
Well, let me put it this way. Yes, there's some progressive, there are a lot of progressive people in Hollywood, and there are a lot of progressive things that they stand for, but, you know, we, Hollywood, they, you know, they endorse things like, you know, cancer and AIDS, and, I mean, there's so many things across the board that people in Hollywood get involved with, so that got nothing to do with liberal, quote-unquote, which is nothing wrong with that.
I didn't say it.
But what's interesting is this movie in particular, there's nothing political about this movie. And if you look at this subject matter, for instance, has to do with national security. That certainly is not thought of as a liberal, quote-unquote.
No, I agree with that. The only political thing about it is the guy who won the presidential election but was not allowed to be president and was vice president for a number of years is the star of the film.
That's right. But even that is, there's not a sort of political angle on. That's part of the journey of the man who's getting
right,
the presentation.
Right. Not yet. Do you think he's going to run?
You know, I don't really know. I mean, he certainly has been very clear that he's not going to run.
Oh, really?
And nothing would make me happier personally if he did.
I'd love him to run, right?
Yeah, I would too. But, you know, what he's doing right now is probably the most important thing in our lifetime, which
I think you're right.
Trying to help solve this Category 5 problem of global warming.
I'm not trying to trivialize that at all, Lawrence Bender. I was just trying to make the point that I'd like to see him run. And also, what's fascinating to me is that there is still a good part of this country that is committed to their ignorance and denial of scientific fact because of business interests and just because they're too dumb to realize that this isn't some sort of propaganda campaign.
Right. Well, you know, what's interesting is that, yes, there are a lot of people who are, you know, including this administration, who's not particularly interested in science. However, I will make a prediction that, and this movie will be part of that movement, that this year we will see a sea change in this because, you know, you cannot ignore what's going on. For instance, I'll tell you something that's kind of ironic. We were supposed to shoot a scene that didn't end up making it into the movie, which was Al Gore speaking in New Orleans. He was set to talk in front of a group of insurers, international insurers,
mm-hmm.
And we couldn't go because Katrina hit, and the whole part of this whole presentation was how storm systems are affecting insurance companies around the world. So you figure when insurance companies are getting worried about global warming, you know, these are people who count numbers and are not, there's nothing political about them, that it's starting to really sink into mainstream business. And I've met with the number one, two person at Safeway. I've spoken to the head of sustainability at Walmart. I've spoken to many, many people in different businesses who are definitely understanding that, one, that global warming is an issue, but also that by taking that on board, that the opportunity it helps so much. You know, the amount of energy and therefore money that you save by turning to renewable energy technologies to help power your corporation, and all the things that you can do to solve this issue are so positive for our country.
I hope that they're thinking in those terms and not the other way. Like, it would frighten me to think that the next big competitive business climate in the future is people that are building things to accommodate a world that is 100 degrees hotter, as opposed to doing things to stop the world from being 100
degrees. It's a scary thought, and what's even scarier is by the time people wake up, if they don't see the writing on the wall now, by the time things start to really happen, it'll be too late. And that's why we made this movie, is to really, it's a wake-up call.
And I think it serves as that, Lawrence Bender. And I also think that, I said it the other day, I said, look, you know, the real challenge of, obviously you're not politicizing it, but I'll politicize it. I think the challenge of the Democrats is really to successfully make global warming as frightening as terrorism to regular people.
You know, to be honest, I'm really hoping that this does not be, I mean, you know, I'd be very upset personally if the Democrats don't take this on board as a serious issue.
Absolutely.
In this year election cycle. But to be honest, we need the Republicans to take this on too.
Now.
And that's right, now. And what's been fantastic is, for instance, Rick Warren came to the premiere in L.A. I sat right next to him. And he was very excited about the movie. He's one of, like, 86 evangelicals who've assigned a letter to the president saying that global warming is real, we're causing it, getting worse, we need to do something about it. And, you know, he sold something like 35 million books. His newsletter goes out to 200,000
people. I know that guy. I see his books in the airport.
This has become an important issue for him. And Rich Cizik, who's on the National Association of Evangelicals, gave us a quote a little while ago saying that there's not an evangelical in this country who should not see this movie, and even if you don't believe in Al Gore's politics, you should see this movie. So,
what, but are you sure they want to see it for the right reasons and not because it gives them a time frame for which they might be able to leave
the
planet?
Well, I'm sure there's some... I know that there's some very extreme right-wing, very strongly conservative evangelicals, but, you know, I think there's a lot of these people are actually understand that this is a problem about God's earth, and that you know, that our liberal and progressive sides have a hard time talking about God, I think, sometimes. But you know, Mother Nature is really part of the Bible too, and I think they see that, and that's what's so interesting, is that this issue can cross all these kind of boundaries. And
it's a great film.
So hopeful about this.
Yeah, it's great, and I'm proud of everybody who did it. And be sure, Lawrence Bender, that you say hello to Lori David for us.
Well, I absolutely will. You've made it a point, so I will. I don't know what happened between the two of you.
Nothing happened. It was just, we were talking. It was just tell her we love her and we'd like her to come back on the show.
I will make sure I love her too.
Okay, and thanks for coming on.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, so we'll be back for some closure. That was good. Go see the movie. That's more reason to see the movie. And I'll tell you about that wedding where I hung out with Davis Guggenheim. Why can't I be a bigger star, damn it? Why am I doing this?
You don't work with puppets.
Are you dying for a calm, reasoned discussion on the controversial issue of stem cell research? Too bad, because Sammy the Stem Cell is coming up next.
Now his co-host won a Peabody Award, Mark Maron.
Congratulations on the Peabody.
Hey, thanks. It happened a few years ago, but I'm still living off of that the laurels. So
yeah, I would live off that as long as possible.
Yeah.
How's the package coming?
Shut up. There's no package.
Look, you and you're complaining about coffee. Did I already bring this up? Here's a couple of things I need to talk about before we get out of here. All right?
Well, go ahead. Get it off your chest. Go ahead. I'm not going to stop you.
First of all, I don't think that you should... don't make me look like some sort of kiss-up to Lori David. I'm not a kiss-up to Lori David. The bottom line is this.
You're kissing up.
Who cares?
First you say you're not a kiss-up, then you say, who cares? Which is it?
I am not kissing up. What I'm trying to do is, this is where we live, Jim. We live here now. Los Angeles. Remember you wanted to move here? Remember you wanted to do this show because you wanted to live in Los Angeles? Remember all that? Well, maybe you might want to think about endearing yourself to the show business community in the sense of perhaps it helps us get guests. Perhaps it'll help us branch out with the show.
I'm okay with that, but there are different ways of doing that. You don't have to completely...
Yeah, well, your life is certainly an example, the example of the right way to endear yourself to people.
Is this going
to
go on?
Huh?
Yeah, you know what?
You mean you want to stop? We'll stop. No, I'm just saying that it's not whether she's right or wrong or anything else. It's just you look at the yearly cause. All right. This is this big event that happened in Las Vegas. Where was the Mark Maron show presence? Nowhere. Why? Because I'm like you. I'm a belligerent dummy who doesn't network properly because I don't think I don't need friends.
I'm not a belligerent dummy. I'm just, saying ask the valid questions. You shouldn't shot down because of that. And if Lori David, I don't think she is doing this. If Lori David is avoiding you or the show because of a question I asked, one question. I asked on a show a while ago, then that is her problem.
No, I think the problem was her inability to have seen that perhaps when you called her a fraud the next day when she was off the air, that maybe that wasn't a joke.
Well, that's another thing.
All right,
yeah. I mean, it was an obvious joke because I said immediately afterwards it was a joke.
And, sure, you're so easy to read.
Well, for God's sakes, if I say it's a joke afterwards, look at my body of work. Don't judge me on one stupid comment, made in a split second.
I'm not judging you. I just don't know if she knew all that.
Well, then she shouldn't, if she's...
Well, let's not bring it up again.
Oh, God.
I was just trying.
Are we still having dinner tonight?
Yeah, sure, man. Sure. I'm not hanging out after. That's all.
I don't like hanging out at that place any more than you do.
Oh, man. How's Heather?
Heather's great.
Okay.
Heather's fine. She's still waiting for that car to arrive.
Did you guys enjoy it? Did you have some champagne that I gave you for your birthday?
Oh, thank you very much for the champagne, by the way.
Did you get drunk?
No, we haven't opened it up yet.
Oh, I thought you guys were going to open it.
We're saving it for,
get drunk and have sex. That's what that's for. That's good champagne.
Should we have sex before we open it up?
No, you get about halfway through the bottle, then you have sex, and then you drink the rest after sex to make you feel like it was good.
Wow.
What happened?
Where'd
I lose you?
That's sad.
I don't know if it's sad. What's everyone telling me I'm sad for? Laura Spencer says my pitch is sad. I'm trying to make a movie. Here's what I wanted to tell you about coffee, though, because you said that you were just determined to make me feel like coffee's bad when all tests indicate it isn't, though it does cause stress. But here, in a study of more than 125,000 people, one cup of coffee per day cut the risk of alcoholic cirrhosis by 20%. Four cups a day reduced the risk by 80%. How do you like that, alcoholics? So make sure you're drinking your coffee.
And five cups reduce the risk of you ever leaving the bathroom.
Yeah. Of course, the other way to handle cirrhosis, maybe cut down the drinking a little bit. Here's a second edition of the Short Order News so you're not caught off guard or uninformed. Three Middle Eastern prisoners being held without charges at Guantanamo Bay hang themselves, prompting new calls for an immediate shutdown. Army officials are playing down the suicides, referring to the hangings as vertical martyrdom. which is really close to the truth, by the way. A main ingredient in beer may help prevent prostate cancer and enlargement, according to a new study. Researchers, however, say that when getting your prostate checked, refrain from telling any doctor, hey, give me a couple of cold ones. This news item has been brought to you by Cancer, the King of Fears. Unfortunately, the compound is present in such small amounts that a person would have to drink more than 17 beers to benefit. And the bad news? Huh? Huh, Andy? The bad news? Yeah, that's right, laughing Andy. German police have arrested a man on suspicion of murdering a woman with a sausage. Forensic experts are still trying to determine how the man managed to cram the sausage link into the gun cylinder. Ugh. Yeah, that's the short order news there. That's going to do it.
Stuck the sausage in the gun.
Well, tomorrow, actually, Peter Beinart, I think that's how I'm pronouncing it, is going to tell us why progressives are failing and how we can succeed. He's got some big ideas. I've read part of his book. I'd have contention with this guy, and I've seen him on TV. We'll talk to him. Sasha Abramski will also talk to us about how the prison state has damaged democracy and pulling felons off the voter rolls and whatnot. Yeah, it's a very interesting book that he wrote that I don't have the name of right in my head. It's going to be good, though. Stay with us till tomorrow. Good night, sheeple. It's called Cond.